So any other questions before we resume? Yeah.
So this here C is a bunch of theta and mu. But I think the original thing you had is this IDU. There must be a factor of d phi wedge du in.
Yeah, this is, let me see what that actually.
Is this a special case or?
I didn't actually explain that. I probably should have. Let's just check that if we had sine theta times C of theta and u, d theta wedge du, I think that's what we have, right? The question is, can we write this in the form d psi of theta and u wedge du?
Also, psi is not a function of phi.
It's a special case.
It's a special case.
Yeah. If I made it a function of phi, then it couldn't fit, I guess, in that form. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
That's all. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think I could. Okay. So before we move to the black hole, I just want to talk about one more thing about this Michael monopole that's missing in this picture. Actually, it's right here, this phi component of the magnetic field. What does it look like in terms of like field lines, and why is it there, or some interpretation of what it implies? Of course, one thing is you can use Ampere's law. You could take a loop that goes around here, around the axis. And since there's current flowing through that loop, that's what these lines were, the current, there must be a line integral of the magnetic field around that loop. And so this B phi is giving you that. And in fact, so the toroidal field, this is called, is directly related to the polar current. There's another point, which is that the field is magnetically dominated. If I only took the outgoing flux solution by itself, I should have said this really, but is a null field. But then I'm adding to it a magnetic monopole. And so when you combine those fields, this extra magnetic part makes the magnetic field greater than the electric field in magnitude. And as we just said at the end last time, as you go far away, the monopole field falls off and you approach that purely null field. But what do the field lines look like, and how can you visualize the field sheets becoming null asymptotically? So I want to talk about that a little bit, because it seems like thinking about field sheets and their geometry is going to be a pretty useful thing to do, especially when you have conservation laws. Because like I said, in effect, particles are confined to move along the field sheets. So they're really moving in little helical cyclotron motions. But if you neglect the small-scale cyclotron motion, they're just moving on the field sheet. And if the field sheet has a killing vector, then presumably there's a corresponding conserved quantity for the particle on the field sheet. So you can calculate orbits of the particles as they're accelerated outward, let's say in this spinning magnetosphere, by using that conservation law. So a nice example is this explicit Michael monopole to just look at what do you get for the field sheet geometry, what kind of killing vectors does it have, etc. And it's really nice and easy to get. So I just want to show you how that works. So this topic is field sheets of the Michael monopole. So just reminding you, if the field is d phi 1 wedge d phi 2, the field sheets are the intersection of constant phi 1 and phi 2 surfaces. So in the case of this monopole, what are these? We could choose phi 1 to be q minus q cosine theta. So let's say phi 1 is minus q cosine theta. And phi 2 is going to be phi minus omega u. That only works if if omega is a constant. So we're considering the constant case. So this is phi minus omega u. U is, let's do it in flat space, it's t minus r. So just to be completely explicit, in flat space, time, the field sheets are going to be constant phi 1 and phi 2 for these two functions. So phi 1 constant means the angle theta is constant. That means that the field sheet's going to be on a cone of fixed angle theta. And then phi 2 is constant. If you want to know what the magnetic field lines look like in the rest frame of the center of symmetry, you just fix t. And then constant phi 2 means that phi minus omega, phi plus omega r is a constant. So we can conclude that the field lines in the t equals constant frame are given by theta equals constant and phi plus omega r equals constant. So for example, in the equatorial plane, there are going to be curves in the plane that satisfy phi plus omega r is constant. And those, as Michael wrote in his original paper in 1973, are Archimedean spirals. He didn't get this by anything like the argument we're giving here. He got it by looking at the different components of the magnetic field. But it's the same thing. So these are the field lines and their spirals whose radius and angle increase in at a fixed proportion as you go out. And if theta is not constant, it's not zero, then you have like a cone and the field lines are helical spirals out in the cone. And they're curving backwards relative to the spin. I think I got all the signs right here, so it actually works. So as r increases, phi would have to decrease, which means that the field, if the thing is spinning this way, if the star is spinning this way, the field line is curving back, like trailing backwards. And you can see that that's just what you need for the field to not be electric outside the light cylinder. See, if you just took a field line that wasn't curving back, say it's doing that, and then imagine it's spinning around, and this is the light cylinder where the radius rho omega equals the speed of light, then a co-rotating point outside that would be moving faster than light in this azimuthal direction. So if the field line were whipping around like that, its field sheet would be space-like instead of time-like. So it would actually be an electric-dominated field. So the only way to avoid that is to take the field line and curve it back this way. Then, you see, if the field line were going like this faster than light, it doesn't matter. It's just, I really hope to convey this without being too confusing. Say here's a time direction in some Lorentz frame and a space direction, say the z direction. Here's a field line. I could have the field line moving to the right at any speed I want, and still the field sheet that it sweeps out is going to be time-like. So that would describe a magnetic field. Whereas if the field line were moving this way, faster than the speed of light, then the field sheet would be tipped over and would be space-like. That would describe an electric-dominated field. So again, what's happening with the Michael solution is that as radius goes, the angle phi, which is going around this way, has to decrease. So this field line bends back around that way, always by enough so that the field sheets are staying time-like. And we know they are because we just look at the form of this F and calculate, let's say it's square, and see that it always has the same sign. So we're just adding a perpendicular magnetic component to an exactly null field, so it's going to be magnetically dominated. Okay, so that was the thing about field sheets. Oh, and it's interesting to ask, what's the induced geometry on these field sheets? Because I said we'd like to know their killing vectors. So to find that, we can just write down the Minkowski metric. And then substitute in these equations. So a given field sheet has a constant theta, so let me put a naught on there. It's just, it's fixed and not changing, and therefore d theta is zero on our field sheet. And now we can choose whether we're going to use, let's say, r or phi as our coordinate. And I think it turns out to be neat to use phi. But then since this is a constant, dr, is that what I want to do? Yeah, I think I didn't recheck this. Hold on a second. I want to do this the right way because it's fun. No, actually, I want to keep r and get rid of phi. And instead of using t, I want to use u, it turns out. So I want to write this as minus du squared plus minus 2 du dr. I think that's, if u is t minus r, this is right, isn't it? Gotta get this sign right. U is outgoing, so dr is minus u for the other one. Yeah, okay, and then plus sine squared theta naught. And then this is just u. So since this is a constant, d phi is equal to omega du. So I'm just going to write here omega squared du squared. And I have to do something with that r there. I just leave it. That's right. Well, I don't know why I'm showing you all these details, just because I thought it was really neat. If you look at this metric and squint your eyes, you realize that it's actually de Sitter space. It's actually two-dimensional de Sitter space. In fact, actually, you don't have to squint very hard to see it. It's just minus one plus a constant, I'll call it h squared. So the constant is omega sine theta. H squared r squared du squared minus 2 du dr. That's it. So it doesn't take much imagination, I think, if you've ever seen the de Sitter metric, to realize this is de Sitter space. With a Hubble constant equal to omega sine theta naught. So what does that mean? Well, de Sitter space is a maximally symmetric space, so we have three killing vectors, and it's just neat. I don't know. Okay. So let's move on to the black hole case, unless there are questions about this.
Space you can in that number of dimensions, and is that saying that the solution is the most symmetric solution? By then, is there?
It sounds like it, but I don't know. Yeah. Another example that we were looking at recently is a cylindrical symmetric solution, a translationally symmetric solution that's also stationary and that might describe a pointing jet. And in that case, the field sheets turned out to be actually flat space. They're curved around as embedded manifolds in Minkowski space, but they're intrinsically flat. So there's another one with the same amount of symmetry. Maybe you could classify solutions according to the symmetry of the field sheets. I don't know. Okay, so let's move on then to the black hole, and I keep getting confused about which piece of paper I want to hold. This is it. Oh yeah, and I guess I forgot to say, we figured out how to generalize this rotating monopole to a whirling monopole. So we can actually let the rotation axis be a function of retarded time and generalize this Michael solution, just as a statement. It's in the paper. So let's now consider a black hole. And I want to start with this famous Wald solution for a black hole spinning not with a plasma surrounding it, but just with an asymptotically uniform magnetic field. So it's going to be a black hole. I don't know what it's going to do there. I don't want to say. So we want a solution with an asymptotic B is equal to just some constant times, z hat. And the black hole is spinning.
It's actually spinning along with the field?
Yes, spinning along with the field. Now, if it were a conductor, before we considered the case of a spinning conductor that also carried its own monopole charge, we saw that the charge in the conductor polarized and developed a surface charge and a non-degenerate field outside. Here, it turns out that even though it has no surface and it's not a conductor, the same thing happens. Of course, we're not going to assign it a monopole charge, although that's an interesting idea. Why not try that? I'll have to think about that later. But what Wald did was he considered an asymptotically uniform. So it's just a black hole embedded in a otherwise uniform magnetic field. And he used the fact that a killing vector on a spacetime defines a vacuum solution to Maxwell's equations. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Eric. Is it just by the killing identity? Yeah. I don't need to go into that maybe. That's a bit of a digression. There's just a nice mathematical fact that a killing vector treated as a vector potential for an electromagnetic field defines a vacuum solution to Maxwell's equations. And in this space-time, we've got time translation and axial rotations. So Wald looked at what kind of electromagnetic fields could you get. And in particular, could you get one that's asymptotically this? And he found the one that you could get that's asymptotically that. That's usually called the Wald solution or something. And like the spinning conductor with this magnetic monopole charge, the field is not degenerate outside this. So E dot B is non-zero for it. So the Wald solution I tried to develop intuition about why, and I really have to say I've pretty much completely failed. The first thing you start thinking about is the dragging of frames and how this ambient B field would appear in the moving frame since you can't not move. It's sort of plausible that you'd have some electric field in the ergosphere, but actually E dot B is not zero everywhere. In fact, it's even not zero along the axis. So there's absolutely no rotation there. So I have to say I completely failed to intuit really what's going on here. And maybe somebody here knows and can tell me or can figure it out, but it's just the result. So, but then given that it's true, then you could say, well, if this black hole was embedded in a field, the field might be anchored in an accretion disk coming from the surroundings, but let's just say the black hole is spinning and it finds itself in a magnetic field. Maybe the field lines thread the horizon initially. In any case, because this E dot B non-zero will develop, if it's strong enough, this electric field will also create a plasma around the black hole. So the same story that we used for the pulsar we could apply here. Of course, a supermassive black hole has a spin rate that's much less than a pulsar, just because it's huge. Even if it's sort of maximally spinning, the angular velocity is much less. And the field is not going to be 10 to the 8 Tesla around a supermassive black hole. So we're scaling way down. But actually, remember the condition we need for force-free is that the field energy is much greater than the matter energy, and you have to see how that works out. I did actually an estimate of it, but I think I forgot to write it down. It turns out that it really seems to work, that as you, it's quite plausible that even though force-free is much less, the ratio of electromagnetic field energy to matter energy would be expected to be much less in this case than in the pulsar case. It's still high enough that force-free is a reasonable thing to use. So I want to consider this problem, assuming that now instead of vacuum, we're surrounding the black hole with a force-free magnetosphere. I'll actually try to write up that estimate I had and show you later, if anybody's interested. There was a simple way to scale it that made it plausible to me. Okay, so what we're going to do is superpose a monopole with an outgoing flux, but we need to do it on the background of a spinning black hole, which is not Schwarzschild but Kerr. And we can't do it, it turns out, analytically. And as I was mentioning at the break, I think it's the reason is nobody's found an analytic solution, and probably nobody ever will, is because we only had an analytic solution for the outgoing flux on Kerr when the flux is riding on the shear-free null geodesic congruence, which is the principal null congruence of Kerr. And the solution you get by superposing the monopole and the outgoing flux in Schwarzschild remains adapted to that congruence because it's simply radial, and the monopole is just radial. But the analog of that monopole in Kerr is not like radial. There's no, you've broken the symmetry, and there's sort of twisting around of the exact monopole solution on Kerr that's incompatible with the twisting around of the shear-free null geodesic congruence. So whatever solution you'd have, it's no longer going to be one of these Robinson solutions that has no backscattering. But that means if you really were to solve it exactly, you would be solving the scattering problem on the Kerr background. And that you can't do analytically for any kind of field, I think. So probably you'll never find an analytic solution. And in any case, Blanford and Znajek just said, let's do it perturbatively. Of course, there are numerical things we could talk about later also. But analytically, they said, let's just perturb in the angular velocity. So that turns out to be quite easy to get the lowest order energy flux and field. So BZ, let's perturb in A, the spin parameter, or equivalently, the angular velocity of the horizon, which I might as well write now is A divided by the horizon radius squared in the usual coordinates plus A squared. So the zeroth order solution is going to be the non-spinning thing. Non-spinning is just a monopole. So we're going to say that F is F0 plus F1, this indicating what order in A that you're talking about. And F0 is going to be the monopole. Later, we can split it and have a split monopole without any problem, because the Kerr solution is reflection symmetric. And here's our perturbed thing. Now, I'm not going to solve this by, you know, I'm just going to write down the answer and show that it works to be the right perturbative thing. So we call this in our paper the BZ ansatz, because it's going to be, it's a little more general than the actual thing. So guess what? We're just going to write down the Michael monopole again. But what are we going to use for the angular velocity? That we're going to leave open for the moment. I guess the first guess would be you should just put in the angular velocity of the horizon, because that's the only velocity you can assign to the spinning black hole. But it turns out if you do that, you get the solution is singular on the horizon. So really what's happening is we don't have a perfectly conducting boundary condition to impose at this horizon, right? So we need some other boundary condition. And what it's going to be is simply regularity at the horizon. And that's going to tell us what this omega has to be. So for the moment, we're just going to leave it open and otherwise write down this solution. But then we're going to interpret these coordinates as Boyer-Lindquist coordinates for Kerr. So we can just interpret this as some field sitting there in the Kerr spacetime. So we export the Michael monopole to Kerr. Exported Michael monopole. Here we interpret theta, phi, and u. Actually, at the moment, we're just talking about the zeroth order. No, we're not. I'm talking about the whole thing. I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry. Theta, phi, and u being the retarded, the Kerr time coordinate. What should I call it? The Kerr u coordinate. It's no longer a retarded time coordinate because the surfaces of constant u are not null in the standard Kerr coordinates.
So it's by the original Boyer-Lindquist, or is it the one that's also
it's the original Boyer-Lindquist. Yeah, so we're just going to take this from Schwarzschild and do the minimal thing to put it in Kerr. And actually, because we're working at first order in omega, and here's an omega here, And presumably this omega, which is the omega of the field, is going to be of the same order as the omega of the black hole. Therefore, what it's multiplying can be treated at zeroth order. So this could just be the U of Schwarzschild in that sense. But when I calculate, I'll go ahead and use U to be the Kerr U when I impose the horizon regularity condition, which I guess is in a certain sense inconsistent, but it's just, there's a higher order correction that, since we're not keeping track of all the omega squared order terms, is not significant.
My natural inclination would have been, if you're going to use that U, you should use the associated phi coordinate.
Well, the problem is, yeah, we'll get to that in just a moment, but the associated phi differs from this phi by a very large amount. I mean, it spins around the black hole an infinite number of times as you approach the horizon compared to what this one does. They differ by a huge amount. So if you're just trying to perturb around just the strict monopole, you shouldn't start by something that's sort of infinitely different, I think, from the zeroth order solution you would want to write. So in that sense, I think it's natural to start with this one. But you'll see very quickly the one you want will appear. We have to talk about it, because this one will be singular on the space-time we're interested in.
That's
our starting point. And now we're going to check, before we worry about the horizon regularity, let's first check whether this even is a solution to force-free electrodynamics to first order in omega. Okay.
So is that for one point?
For the whole thing. Okay, so first we should make sure, of course, that it satisfies Faraday's law, which it does by inspection. So D of F BZ ansatz equals zero, checks, because the only place we have a function is sine theta, and D theta wedge D theta is zero. And now the force-free condition. We'll use, we only want to impose it at lowest order. So what are the force-free conditions? Remember, they're alpha wedge J equals zero and beta wedge J equals zero. J actually has no zeroth order part, because the zeroth order solution is the monopole, and that's a vacuum solution. But if we only want to impose these equations at first order, that means we can use the zeroth order alpha and beta.
Can you repeat that?
Yes. We want to impose these at first order. So at zeroth order, they're satisfied because J is zero at zeroth order. At first order, this will be alpha first order wedge J zeroth order plus alpha zeroth order wedge J first order. But again, J has no zeroth order part. So really, we just have to impose that the zeroth order alpha wedge the first order J is zero. And similarly for beta. But we can just read off the zeroth, at zeroth order, all we have is the monopole, and alpha and beta are proportional to d theta and d phi. So really, we're just saying all we have to say impose is that d theta wedge, the first order j is zero, and d phi. So these are the equations we have to verify. So to do that, we have to calculate the current to first order in the spin parameter. Now, that's going to be D. Current is D star F. So it's D of the first order part of star F. Which is equal to, it receives a contribution from the first order part of star times the zeroth order part of F. And the zeroth order part of star and the first order part of F. Okay, so we just have to look at them separately. I guess I'll first look at this one. So the first order part of F goes like d theta wedge du. So its dual, its zeroth order dual, is just going to be another null form where you replace d theta by something proportional to d phi. And you, because of the, and you're not going to introduce any R dependence there. So this goes like D of D theta will be replaced by a sine D phi. So it's going to go like a sine squared theta D phi wedge DU. Times some coefficients.
A question.
Yes?
U is no longer a null, or U equals constant is no longer a null hypersurface. Is the dual still space-like rotation with no R?
Wait a minute, that's a very good question. Because we're working to first order and we're assuming that omega itself is first order in the spin, because it's the correction due to the spin.
Right.
We can neglect the, we can use u to zeroth order in calculating this dual. So that's the form of that. And then we're still having this to do, which let me analyze later. This will give us something that goes like d theta wedge d phi wedge du. So it's something times. And remember, all we're trying to verify is that d theta wedge are current and d phi wedge it gives zero. This contains both a d theta and a d phi. So this piece of the first order current will satisfy that condition, and we just have to worry about the second piece. So for the second piece, we're dualizing, let's write out what it is. It's the first order dual of the monopole d theta wedge d phi times some stuff. Well, let me commute those. Now, you can sort of do this just by inspection if you think about it for a second. At zeroth order, the dual of the two-form d theta wedge d phi is going to be proportional to the two-form dt wedge dr. It's the orthogonal subspace. What's changing now when I go to first order is that the metric picks up a GT phi piece. The lowest order term in the Kerr metric, the only first order term in the spin in the Kerr metric is the T phi off diagonal component. So that's all we have to think about, is that it's going to mix T and phi. So when we think about this dual, the slickest way to do it is to group the four one forms in a basis into two orthogonal groups. Let's take the theta r piece. We'll consider d theta and dr as 2, and then d phi and dt as 2. And these guys are orthogonal to these guys to lowest order in A in the Kerr metric. Actually, I guess they're orthogonal to all orders in Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. That means when I dualize this 2 form, I can just dualize d theta in this subspace and dualize d phi in this subspace. Because remember, the dual of a 2 form is just the orthogonal 2 form of the same magnitude. And if I can have a clever way to come up with the orthogonal one, that's up to me. So certainly I'll construct the correct thing if I just take the orthogonal thing to d theta in this subspace, which is going to be dr. And in this subspace, take the orthogonal thing to d phi, right? But at zeroth order, that would just be dt. But I'm looking for the first order part of that. But that's going to be another d phi piece. The off-diagonal term between dt and d phi is precisely the term that says that the dual in the d phi dt subspace of d phi has a piece proportional to d phi. So this is just my way of liking to do things without writing equations. But you could write all this out in equations and get very confused about it. So I'm claiming that it's clear that this dual is going to go like dr wedge d phi. It's also going to be a function. Now, what's this thing multiplying it? We need to know what it's a function of because we're taking its derivative. Well, the Kerr metric has r dependence and phi and theta dependence, but no t and phi dependence. So this is going to be some function of r and theta times this, but not t and phi. And now I'm supposed to take d of it. Now, the df will give me a df dr times dr plus df d theta times d theta. But dr wedge dr will give me 0. So basically, once again, I'll get something of the form. So this thing goes like d theta wedge dr wedge d phi. And sure enough, this has both a d theta factor and a d phi factor, which is what needs to be true for force free. So we just verified that this ansatz does indeed satisfy all the equations of force free. And we can just now consider the boundary condition. But let me pause for questions since that might have been obscure.
I wonder if you pushed your luck a little bit and said, OK, I'm going to be working in linearized curve. So slow rotation, but you made this ansatz and tried to treat it as an exact solution in that background spacetime, which is just linearized Kerr. Would there be an exact solution in that background spacetime? Would that work?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think I asked myself that question before.
Because I guess I was wondering when you were describing before the obstacle that you face when you try to superpose the solutions in Kerr. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering whether those are linear order in A obstacles or they're quadratic in A obstacles. And if so, then maybe you could evade the obstacles if you just linearized.
You might have to do that question I was asked earlier, though, about du not being null in Kerr would come up. But then I could fix that by just taking the I could perhaps to first order an A make it. No, but see, then it's an approximate solution. Yeah, no, there could be a snag, but I think it's a neat question and would be worth figuring it out. I also should mention, since you're mentioning being more ambitious, that Blandford and Znajek actually found the solution to second order in A. The reason we're not going to do that, and for what you're suggesting, if it could work, could be a good way to do that. But we don't need to, because it turns out the lowest order energy flux is obtainable. It comes from the first order solution, so it's enough to get that. And I don't know what we really need the second order one for these purposes. So
So the energy flux would be like linear in A, you're saying, or is it quadratic?
It'll be quadratic. The actual flux will be quadratic in A.
So don't you have to check the second order pieces?
You do, but I'll check and show you that they... You don't have to check them explicitly.
Okay.
Well, okay, since you said this already, I might as well say. I think what you're saying is that the stress tensor is quadratic in the field. So if you want that to second order, it could get contributions from the zeroth order part. Zeroth order part plus the second order times the second order part. But then if you think about it, the zeroth order part is this monopole, which has only theta phi components. And when you construct the stress tensor out of that, you're never going to generate a TR component of the stress tensor by multiplying the monopole with the second order. Whatever the second order is, you'll never generate a TR component. So it's not saying that you can get the full stress energy to second order, but you can get the part of it that describes outgoing flux. Okay, so, right, so we verified that we've satisfied to first order the equations, and we should worry about now the boundary condition. That being that this is not singular on the horizon. Ab initio, it looks quite singular, because as Eric was pointing out, d phi is singular. Luckily, however, du is also singular.
Yeah.
On the future horizon, if u is the outgoing Kerr coordinate, it's regular on the past horizon, which is not astrophysically relevant, but it's singular on the future horizon. So maybe, just maybe, we could arrange for the singularity in this to cancel the singularity in this. If we can, it'll only be by choosing a very specific value of omega. So let's try it. Is this where I left that page? So we have to write out the form of the singularities. Oops, I can't do that. I don't want to erase that. So what is this singularity in d phi, let's say? Well, this will just be not so much explaining, but reminding you if you've not seen this, if you've seen this before. So we can introduce a new angle coordinate that differs by a function of radius from phi, such that this is regular, and that's the Kerr angle coordinate. It's different for regularity on the future and past horizon, and I'm doing the one that's regular on the future horizon. And it's minus A over delta, which goes to zero at the horizon, dr. Delta is R minus times R minus R plus, where R plus or minus is M plus or minus the square root of m squared minus a squared, which is the outer and inner horizon radius. So at the horizon, delta goes to zero. So this dr piece is infinite, but this is regular. So we've been able to write down the form of that singularity. And du, we can trade the outgoing for the ingoing Kerr coordinate, which is called v, and which is regular on the future horizon. And these differ by something of a similar form, minus twice r squared plus a squared over delta dr. So we just want to basically substitute these expressions in for d phi and du here. So we get d d phi minus omega du is d phi tilde minus omega dv. Which is regular as long as omega is regular, plus the rest. And the rest is what? How do I want to write this? Okay, the omega part. Minus omega du is going to be plus omega times this. So it's plus 2 omega r squared plus a squared over delta. I'll leave out the delta to the end. And I'm going to have a dr over delta. And then from the d phi part, I'm going to have a minus a over delta. But a is omega horizon times r plus squared plus a squared. So this is omega horizon r plus squared plus a squared. Now we want this to be regular on the horizon. Delta is going to zero, so this coefficient has to go to zero. On the horizon, r is equal to r plus, so this factor is equal to this factor. So we just read off, the only way to make it, to have a chance that it's regular on the horizon is if omega is 1/2 of the horizon angular velocity. If it is, in fact, we will cancel off the pole in delta. So this implies, whoops. Yeah, I don't need that anymore. So FBZ equals Q sine theta d theta wedge d phi minus 1/2 omega h du is regular on the future horizon. So that condition told us what the angular velocity of the field should be.
You're ruling out a radial dependence.
Wait a minute. What do you mean by ruling out?
Oh, because omega could depend on r, right? This is only the leading term in.
Well, my ansatz.
Is that it only depends on theta or?
Was actually my ansatz to verify the first order force free equations, I needed that it only depended on theta and u, probably. But then I'm actually finding out it can't depend on theta or u. It has to be constant and equal to this value. Right. So no differential rotation for this solution. Okay, let's see.
Give me a physical reason why they're only going at half the speed.
Well, I want to, and I sort of can. And that was actually what I was, I only have 10 minutes to, all right, so we're gonna have to finish even this next time before we start the next topic. So what should I use now? The physical reason Well, first we should say, something I forgot to ever say was, in what sense are the magnetic field lines even rotating? The sense is the field sheets Remember, we wrote down the field sheet condition. Did I erase that board? Probably. Yeah. The second Euler potential had the form phi minus omega t minus r in the Michael monopole. So if we, you know, sit at a fixed radius, phi has to advance at a rate of omega. So in that sense, the field sheet is moving around azimuthally at fixed radius at angular velocity omega. You can also consider you're at fixed angle, and then the field sheet has to be moving outwards at the speed of light. The field line, rather, sorry. So there are different ways to think about the motion of field lines, but one way is certainly here to think about the field line itself as rotating with this angular velocity. And Eric's asking me, why is the, it's clear when the field is stuck on a conducting star that the field lines are going to be somehow moving around at the same angular velocity, because remember we're imposing that in the frame of the star there's no electric field. Here though, it's different. It's not surprising that it's different because there's no surface, but why is it what it is? My best explanation, I see people starting to gather for the next course. I don't want to make the mistake I made last time. I think a really nice analogy is that it's an induction generator, an asynchronous induction generator, which I've been reading about. I don't know if anybody here know about what an asynchronous induction generator is. This is like what they use in windmills to generate electricity. There's something called a rotor that turns and a stator that's not turning. And the rotor is the analog for the black hole is that the black hole is the rotor and the plasma around it is the stator. And if you're asking about, actually, let me say it this way, because the intuition is better when you run it as a motor instead of as a generator. So you can take this arrangement with a rotor. It's just a cage of conductors that can spin on an axis. And suppose you put around it a magnetic field configuration that itself is rotating in time, because you've made electromagnets there, or because you have permanent magnets that are spinning around. And you just make a rotating magnetic field. Well, then that will induce currents in the rotor, which then will interact with the magnetic field, and the rotor will start to spin. It's like a Lenz's law thing. So that's a way to drive a motor by having a rotating magnetic field and a rotatable conducting spindle. So like a fan works that way, a lot of fan motors, I think. It's asynchronous because the rate of rotation of the rotor is not the same as the rate of rotation of the magnetic field that's going around it. And in fact, the difference between those two rates is called the slip. And the amount of power delivered to the motor is a function of the slip. And it maximizes at a certain relative velocity that depends on the nature of the circuit and on the load. Okay, so now let's go backwards and run it as a generator instead of as a motor. We're going to turn the rotor and generate a current in the stator. The maximum power we deliver to this, or the slip between them, is going to be determined by the nature of the circuit and the load that we're trying to drive with this current. So in general, though, they're not going to be in phase. And in fact, if they were exactly in phase, there's zero power transfer. Zero. The maximum power transfer happens when they're offset by some amount. I'm not deriving that it's zero, but I'm telling you that's a basic result. I think it's easy to show it. So for the black hole, no power would be coming out if this omega were equal to omega h. I mean, aside from the fact that also the solution would be singular. But let's say there was another solution that's not the same as the BZ one. If it had this omega equal to omega h, no power would come out. As I'll show you in the next meeting, there's a general formula for the power. So that's, I better quit because they're gathering and they need 5 minutes to set up. So we'll continue tomorrow and on this and more.